It's the 17th of February, and we have an exam coming up on Thursday, chapters 1 and 4. So the introduction to investments, risk versus return, overview of investments, short-term investments, and then mutual funds. We're going to finish up mutual funds today and spend a little bit of time reviewing if you have questions individually. Yes? The regular 51, the one that has 50 on the front and the back. No calculations, although there's some calculations in Chapter 1 that we did not go over. They will not be on the exam. We will come back to present value in a few weeks. You get one page of handwritten notes, 8.5, regular sheet of paper, front and back. So please do take advantage of that. Questions, thoughts, ideas, comments about the exam? No? All right. And you know the thing, there's checking for comprehension questions that we did with the ABCDs. Those are very similar to the type of questions you will see on the exam. I tried the multiple choice Scantron. I try to make them as straightforward as possible. Sometimes you screw up as a prof, but I do my best. Okay, now, so we're going to finish up Chapter 4. We have some literature to take a look at, and then we're going to do a couple of case studies. But first, we need a good joke. Anybody got a good joke? No? No. Okay, I told you about the alligator who walked into the bar, right? And the mushroom and the duck, right? Did I tell you about the neutron?
Yeah.
And the rhinoceros? I didn't tell you about the rhinoceros? Well, let me tell you. This rhinoceros walks into a bar and orders a beer. And the bartender says, sure, would you like to charge it? Told you they'd get worse. All right, so we're going to scan through a few of these slides right here because this stuff is pretty straightforward. One of the cool things about mutual funds is how... Oh, we forgot to look. Oh, my goodness. Oh, I forgot to look. We forgot to look at how well we're doing. Well, some of you did. This is very cool when we have stocks, individual stocks that explode on the upside, 17.5%. But then look, a couple of stocks not doing so well, and we're up, still almost 4% in 4 weeks is pretty darn good, folks. Do not expect that those kind of returns, but still, we're doing all right. Google's flat, 3M is flat, Pfizer's up a little bit, but look at Procter & Gamble. Don't worry, people will continue to take showers and wash their clothes and use toilet paper and toothpaste and shaving cream. What? Starbucks? What is that? Oh, yeah, Starbucks up 11%. That's pretty good. Oof, you got the wrong guy. I do not understand why people spend $5 for a cup of coffee. I'm the wrong person to talk about. Now, mutual funds are extremely convenient. Most people start off putting $50, $100 a month. We'll discuss dollar cost averaging in detail. Pay yourself first. In my humble opinion, this is the absolute best way to invest in a mutual fund. You don't worry about when it's a good time to invest. Every month, $50, $100 a month, and whatever you can afford, comes out of your paycheck. And it's the truth that it's practically the only way that most of us working grunts are going to invest. You'll hear people say, oh, I want to wait till I have $5,000 or $10,000 to play the market. When's that going to happen? Is $5,000 just going to drop in your lap someday? Yeah, it will. Good. But until then, put $50 a month away, all right? And then, unless you tell them otherwise, they will automatically reinvest the dividends. They will, any capital gains, any dividends that they distribute to you, which they're required by law to do, will just automatically go back into the mutual fund. They'll purchase more shares. Unless you need the income, which is normally something somebody does in retirement, it's always a good idea to reinvest the dividends and capital gains. And if you don't specify which, they will automatically reinvest. When do you take the money out? Well, sometimes you have a big purchase, so you're saving for a home or a down payment or whatever. But most of the time, you're going to be putting in the money over 30 years. You're going to be taking it out over the next 30 years, assuming you live that long. And you have a systematic withdrawal plan that's monthly or quarterly, sometimes annually, but it's just easy. It's all electronic. It's transferred directly to your checking account, so you do that every month. When you're in a family of funds and you're starting to come down the risk versus reward spectrum, if you can remember that, I didn't redo it on the board, but you can take advantage of the conversion privilege or exchange privilege. So they will automatically, or you can do it as you want to, they will automatically move it from one fund to another fund without any extra fees. But if it's in a regular account, it will trigger tax consequences. The IRS will want, hey, you sold one investment, one mutual fund, bought another one. You have to pay taxes on that. If it's in a retirement account, they don't care because it doesn't tax until you take the money out, unless it's a Roth, and then you're never taxed. How do you buy them? As we said, closed-end ETFs, you go through a stock exchange, open-end, through a broker, directly from the investment company. The best way, in my humble opinion, is from automatic contributions. How do you sell? Again, closed-end ETFs, make sure you remember those. We're going to ask you about those. Through the stock exchange, open-end, through your broker, through the mutual fund, and the best way, in my whole opinion, is automatic withdrawals. And we said that a few of these companies are getting very smart, Vanguard, Fidelity. If you buy ETFs through their company, they created their own brokerage firm, then you don't pay any commissions. Very smart. Now, taxes. You got to talk about taxes, right? Well, taxes and mutual funds get people angry. Because normally what they're doing is they are reinvesting the dividends back and the capital gains back into the mutual fund. They're not getting a check in their pocket. They're not getting money in their pocket. So the IRS doesn't care that you reinvested it back into the mutual fund. They say, look, you made money, you owe us taxes. So people sometimes get upset, especially if the mutual fund goes down, if the investment goes down, they're still required to distribute their capital gains and dividends. So people get, they get a tax bill. No, at first, it's not going to be much, folks. When you first start off, it's not going to be a whole lot. When it becomes a whole lot, congratulations. When all of a sudden you go, oh, I got a $3,000 tax bill, congratulations. So people go to their congressperson and say, this is ridiculous. I didn't make any money. I did all. I just put it back in the mutual fund. Why do I have to pay taxes? And so the Congress bozos someday say, well, maybe we'll change that. It ain't never going to happen, folks. Every few years they float this idea of having unrealized capital gains, in other words, paper profits, not be subject to taxes until you sell your mutual fund shares. Forget it. It would create an accounting nightmare. It's not going to happen. So for that reason, if you're going to make a large purchase, and at the end of the year, wait until they've distributed the dividends and the capital gains. Because what some people do, they get an inheritance or $10,000, $15,000, they put it in, and then next day or next week, they distribute their dividends, and now they owe a big tax bill. And they just put the money in. So if that's you, call me or talk to somebody who's savvy about taxes. You wait until after to distribute the dividends. We'll discuss this more when we get the tax, when we get the stock. If it's in a regular account, you don't care. I mean, in a retirement account, you don't care about taxes until you retire, in which case, if it's in a 401k, traditional IRA, you'll be taxed as income. If it's in a Roth IRA or a Roth 401k, you guys remember that from 121? No taxes. Roth is very cool. We'll discuss these way at the end of the semester, but we discussed them quite a bit in the 121 class. Where do you get the information? Well, we briefly made reference to the prospectus. It used to be 30-some-odd pages. And then the SEC finally acknowledged that nobody reads the darn thing. So now, if you're a broker, you have to give your client a summary prospectus. You can still give them the real one, but nobody uses them anymore because they just get thrown away. And go ahead, read it. It's very useful, folks. If you ever have insomnia at night, start reading the prospectus, and within a few moments, you'll be sound asleep.
stove. Here's what we are required to give people. Now, much of it's electronic, right? So what do? You click on this little button, and you don't even have to download the darn thing. You just say, yeah, I read it. Nobody reads them. This is the quarterly statistical update. Another piece of information that is very good for insomnia that brokers are also required to give to their clients, prospectus clients, and nobody reads those either. The prospectus is a statement describing the risk factors, description of the fund's past performance, describes the type of investments, information about dividends, distributions, and taxes, funds management fees. Nobody reads them unless you've taken Business 121, which I ask you to. I have the links to all those prospectuses on the website, so check out a few. But more importantly for most people is the annual report. So if you were not here on last Thursday, I have some annual reports for you to use for your assignment sheet. And so that's where the good stuff is for most people. The problem with the annual reports is sometimes the manager is doing a little dance and trying to show you why they didn't do a very good job. But if they're honest, they're honest. If they're not honest, well, what are you going to do? But just because a mutual fund doesn't do well over 1 or 2 years is not a reason to get rid of it. Look at, my humble opinion, look at 10, 20, 30 or more year returns. And that's what I look at. I don't care. 1 year you don't do as well, that's okay. That's going to happen. Financial publications, well, the two big groups out there are Morningstar and Lipper. Lipper's the older one, more stodgy. Morningstar is the newer one, more flashy. They get me angry, but they're a good source. When you use them, if you use them for your annual report assignment, make sure you be careful because they're going to continually try to sign you up for premium services. You know, we'll give you this stuff for free, but oh, you sign up for premium services. You can get both of these at the library for free. Business Week, Forbes, Kiplinger's, Finance, Personal Finance, Money Magazine, they have these surveys. They sometimes will highlight the past 1 or 2 year performance. I think you should look at least 5, 10 years or more, but that's up to you. The websites, Morningstar.com, be careful, they're going to try to sign you up. Finance.yahoo, still okay, but it used to be a whole lot better. And then the mutual fund company websites. At the end of the 1990s, when the internet was exploding, these guys, you know, they got a lot of resources at their disposal. They started doing some awesome websites, especially T. Rowe Price, Vanguard. And then after the bear market 2000 to 2002, for some reason, I don't know if the SEC came down on them or if they decided, you know, we're not going to promote ourselves as much, they kind of just pared them back. I was really sad, especially Vanguard. Vanguard was awesome. They had this investing university, IU, investment in university, and it was pretty useful. But now the mutual fund websites are again promoting education. So there are links to all these websites on my on the class page, and you will see insights, perspective, and they'll tell you what they're thinking about what's going on. And some of them do a very good job, and some of them are not so great. Dodge and Cox. These people, they're really good, folks, but they're strange. And you watch them, and they seem like people right out of Centerville in the Midwest. And they're in San Francisco. So figure that one out, right? They're in San Francisco, which is, you know, one of the most cosmopolitan cities in the country and the world. And so multicultural, and they all look like they're from Iowa. And they kind of talk like they're all from Iowa. But they have awesome returns. So check them out. Franklin Templeton, good. I'm a big fan. I think you know, American. The Motherlode, for those of you who are into statistics up the yin-yang, is the Investment Company Institute. So if you're so inclined, you can find out quite a bit. I spend some time on there, but it's overwhelming. So we went through the fees, we went through the different types of mutual funds, we went through the fund families. The question is now, how do you pick a mutual fund? Did you get that feeling last Thursday? That was the idea, that this is impossible. This is just so ridiculous, right? That's the idea. That's what I was trying to shoot for you, because that's what people feel like. That's what they feel like. So what we're going to do now is take a look at a single mutual fund. Now, I'm not promoting this one, folks. I'm not saying this is the one you should use. One of the reasons I use it is because, first of all, it's been around. It's one of the oldest mutual funds around. It's been one of the most successful. And they've got this bitchin' sales piece, which I use, which has been copied by many other companies in the industry. So that's a good sign. When somebody, if you're going to steal, folks, steal from the best. Okay, that's always a good sign. So how do you pick a mutual fund? Well, here, this is, it's not easy. It's too, yes? Got a couple extras in the back? Pass them that way. How many do you need?
Three.
Okay, four. There you go. Pass these guys back. It's just simply not easy. Now, here's my recommendations. Here's my advice for what it's worth. You want to pick a mutual fund and invest in high-quality stocks or bonds. Now, how do you define high-quality stocks or bonds? That's not an easy thing to do to begin with, as we'll see when we get to chapters 5 and 6. But hopefully by the end of our discussion of stocks, you will have a good feel for what we mean by quality as it pertains to you. Are you interested in more high growth or more value, whatever those two things are? We'll discuss those later on. Is well diversified. We want good diversification, folks. Diversification is good. It means that something in your portfolio will be lousy, like a Procter & Gamble, but other things will be good, like an Apple and a First Solar. Has a long-term perspective, and a manager, or better yet, in my humble opinion, a management team with many years of experience. For decades, they're changing. The industry is changing. But for decades, and Fidelity was part of the reason, but people were copying them because they were the leader. Companies would shuffle their managers like a deck of cards. You would get this high, powered young guy or gal into the position coming out of Wharton School of Management or Harvard or whatever, Stanford, and throw them into the milieu, throw them into the mutual fund industry, and say, here you are, kid, here's $1 billion. How do you do? And if they did well, after a couple years, they got to stay, they got showered with love and attention and money. But if they didn't do well, out the door. So the tenure at the height was 4 years. The average mutual fund manager had a length of service of 4 years. Now, obviously, some of them were a lot longer. So that means many of them didn't last 2 years. And so what did that, these people are not stupid. They take the CFA, the CHFA, the Chartered Financial Analyst. It's one of the toughest exams in the world. And they've come out of the best schools in the world. And so they know they only got 2 years, 18 months, to do well. So what many of them did was they would roll the dice. They would really try to make eye-popping returns, knowing that if they failed, oh well, they're going to be gone anyway. But if they succeed, great, they get to stay. Now, is that necessarily in the best interest of the shareholders? In my humble opinion, no. No, it's not in the best interest of the shareholders. And if we have time, we'll discuss the guy who started Fidelity and how his vision, which since then, I believe, has been repudiated by many in the industry. So now, the tenure was up, last time I heard, was over 5 years. So it's going up. They're giving people more and more time. And you want to look at a company that has been around for decades and it performed consistently well in both good and bad years. Don't tell me how well you did during good years, because personally, I'm not interested. I want to know how well you did when the organic matter hit the ventilating device, when the wheels fell off, when the world ended. Because that's when you test a person's mettle. That's when you, not only the shareholders, but also the investment managers. Because they're going to happen. So I submit to you that here is one such mutual fund. I am not saying go out and buy this mutual fund. That's not what I'm saying. But I want you to take a look at this one and see how well some of these guys have done and gals have done over decades. So what I want you to do is open up to the middle. And you millennials won't know what we boomers, but we boomers, we go, whoa. You see, you don't understand. We had to steal our father's Playboy. You millennials just go up in your room and click, click, click. And what? Ew, that's good. So open up to the middle, and you'll see 80 years of investment experience. These guys started, actually it started before then, but the people who took it over in January 1st, 1934. I think it was actually December 31st, 1933. But the industry uses $10,000. Whenever you get some kind of piece of literature, you're going to see $10,000 investment. How would it do? I don't know why. That's what the SEC tells them to do. And so go all the way to the right-hand side, all the way to the top. Some of you have seen this already. I apologize. And what have they returned over 80 years? What's there been their annual average return?
12.2.
You see 12.2 all the way to the right, yeah, and then at the top. Now, what do we reasonably expect from stocks over the long term? What do we, I remember from our review, what can we reasonably expect from stocks over the long term? 8, 9, 10%. That's what I tell people. It's actually more. But don't tell them that because they'll get excited. You know, get temper their enthusiasm. And these people, and they're not the only ones, have done 12%. Pretty darn good, right? Would you be happy with that?
Yeah.
I'd be more than happy. If you give me 8, 9%, I'm a happy man. 10, anything above 10, I'm in heaven. But some people, oh, of course you've got to at least that much. But that means you're taking on a whole lot more risk. And what did that $10,000 become as of January 31st, 2013? The 2014 one hasn't come out yet. I apologize. What was it? You see the 97. It's actually over right now. As of 2014, it's like 108 million, 109 million. Pretty good? Yeah. What if you instead put your money into bonds? What can we reasonably expect from bonds? Yeah, 4 to 8. Right now, less. But look in the middle where it says 6.7, which is not, you know, it says stock market with dividends excluded. Just ignore that. But just figure if we had turned our $10,000 investment into 6.7% return, we would have gotten $1.8 million. Which is pretty darn good, right? I mean, bonds didn't do shabby, but wouldn't you rather have the return from stocks? Yeah. And then, of course, if you put it in the bank, short-term interest rates, what are you going to get? Well, right now you're getting nothing. But over the long term, 2 to 5, yes. Right here. This one right here. 6.7%. Down here it's 12.2, 6.7. Now go to the bottom, where it says consumer price index, which is what, 3.7? Now, banks have done a little bit better than that, like 3.9. But what did it turn your $10,000 into?
96.
Now, you understand why you get a toaster from the bank and they treat you so nice? Because they've taken this class and they know that they're going to do better. But, was it a smooth ride? Hell no. This is a logarithmic scale. If you look on the very left-hand side, you'll see that every increment is a factor of 10. Right? It goes up from you know, 10,000 to 100,000, then to a million, and then to 10 million and 100 million. So it's a logarithmic scale. And logarithmic scales are used when the graph is exponential. Because what it does is it turns an exponential graph into a straight line. Now, if you know what the hell I'm talking about, don't worry, because it's not a math class. But those little squiggles, those little up and down squiggles, they don't look big, but they is. Look at 1972. At the very bottom of the column, very bottom, you'll see a number, 1.2 something or other. 1972. You see it? What is that? 1.2? Okay, that's $1,230,000 at the end of 1972. In 73 and 74, it was a very serious, the worst since the Great Depression at that time, serious downturn. At the end of 1974, your $1.2 million was then...
No, you're going one year or two ahead.
Go to one, end of 1974.
840,000.
You lost $400,000. Now, what would you do? Not tell your wife or husband, right? But did you sell? Because look at what happens. 1976? Okay. You see? This is going to happen to you, folks, at least once, twice, maybe three times in your investing career, depending how old you are. I wish I would have saved these interviews sometimes. I don't save them. They asked Warren Buffett, because he thinks they're going to stay on the internet, but they don't. They asked Warren Buffett during the downturn in 2008-9. Now, Mr. Buffett, this woman, she's so stupid. These people are so stupid. But they look good. See, I don't like television. I like to read. She goes, now, Mr. Buffett, your stock has lost 50% of its value. You've lost 50% of your value. Aren't you upset? He goes, no, not at all. I hope I live long enough for it to happen a couple more times. It's happened in the past. It's going to happen in the future. And she just looked at him like, oh, my God. Okay, look at 1987. In the beginning of 1987, actually, at the end of 1986, you had about $6.5 million. By August, it was over $9.5 million. The market went up at 40% in 8 months. Did you hang on? Because in 3 months later, it was back down to $6.5 million. Think about what people did. It goes up 40%. They run in the door because there's look, you're going to get rich. They're giving away money. Ooh, is it too late to get in? And then it falls 30 to 40%. Ooh, is it too late to get out? And then, in 2008, folks, look at 2007. 70 million. And then the end of 2008. It was not a fun year, folks. But it's going to happen. Did you run? Did you hide? Did you hang on? I hope so, because by... 5 years. It took 5 years. It was a very difficult time, folks. The worst since the Great Depression. Questions, thoughts, comments, ideas, criticisms, suggestions? Yes, George.
The fluctuation, is it like in stocks? Like, does it have to do like with the world events? Like what's going on in freaking Syria or whatever? Is that why it's like
fracking? Fracking. In the fracking. George's question was the volatility. Why is it there?
Yeah.
Why? Investor expectations about the future. And we're going to learn more about that when we get to Chapter 6, investor psychology and the way people panic. Yes?
So all these things they've written, the reasons,
they
may be or may not be, right?
Oh, yeah. No, you don't know. You don't know, but look at all these disasters. People say it's a mess. It's always a mess. The world is always a mess. Yes? No. Well, it depends on which one you measure. But no, the Great Depression, the S&P 500, the Dow lost 89% or 88%, almost 90%. The Standard & Poor's 500 from I forget the exact number, but it was over 50 from top to bottom. But it wasn't 2008. It went from near the end of 2008 fall to March of 2009. And so I forget exactly from trough to bottom. We should look. We should look that up. But it wasn't as bad as the Great Depression. But it was the worst since the Great Depression. So it was a rough time. And we didn't have 25% of people unemployed. And we didn't have soup lines out the door. But that's not to say it wasn't a rough time. We had a lot more unemployment than what the official unemployment number was. So are stocks risky? In the short term, yes, but in the long term, no. Think of that yo-yo going up the stairs with the yo-yo. It's going to bounce up and down, but you're still going up as the world economy improves. Now's not a good time to invest. When is it ever a good time to invest? When it feels like a good time to invest, that's usually the worst time. When everybody feels like, hey, everybody's going to get rich, that's usually the time you just, when everybody's running one direction. That's the saying. What do people do? We're going to see a graph. They do the exact opposite. They buy high, sell low. Because we're humans. What about market downturns? Keep a long-term perspective and dollar cost averaging. Because most of us working grunts are not going to have $10,000 to put in. Dollar cost averaging, I want you to memorize this slide. I know you won't, but do it anyway. A system of buying an investment at regular intervals with a fixed dollar amount. It is the most boring, stupid sounding of description and definition, but it works, folks. And the cool thing about this, my wife, when I first met my wife, I knew two things. This is the woman I was going to marry and make her life miserable. And two, we were going to keep our finances separate. She was terrified of the stock market. And I would, for several years, it took me a while to get her accustomed to it. Why are we putting all this money in stocks? They don't mean anything. I said, yeah. What's that car you're driving? What do you mean? What's that car I'm driving? Did somebody make that? Did you make that car? No. Anyway, I would always tell her, Anita, because that's her name. When we wake up tomorrow morning, no matter what happens, there's good news. And she'd roll her eyes. Because if the market's up, that's good news. Yippee! Right? We made 4% in 1 month. If the market's down, that's good news. What are you talking about? Well, next month you're going to get more shares at a lower price, right? The people who kept putting money in 73 and 74, and in 2000 to 2002, and 2008, 2009, they were buying low and sell, right, as George said. Your average cost per share, I want you to memorize that line. You're not going to remember it, and that's okay. We'll come back to it at the end of stocks and bonds. Your average cost per share should be less than your average price per share because you're buying fewer shares when the price is high. You're buying more shares when the price is low. It is not a guarantee. If it just keeps going down and down and down, you go, oh, good, I'm getting more shares. But there, you know, yes? The mutual fund will handle it, or your broker. It'll happen automatically because you'll sign a form saying it's okay for you to take out $50 a month out of my checking account, out of my paycheck, and send it to the mutual fund. It'll happen all automatically. And it's practically the only way most people are going to invest. Questions, thoughts, ideas, comments? Okay, let's continue. Now, the mutual fund industry and the life insurance industry and the brokerage firms have all these things called hypothetical illustrations. They are sometimes called illustrations, hypotheticals. They are examples of returns. I'm going to go over here because I think they're not set up right. They are examples of returns of lump sum investments, which is what they show you here, $10,000. Or a series of investments, stream of deposits, dollar cost averaging, or combinations. And they must be approved by the Securities Exchange Commission and FINRA. You have to be a licensed individual to show these things. And that's why if you call the mutual funds, they don't really want to do it. They'll refer you to a broker. If they have in-house brokers like Fidelity or Vanguard, they'll send you to their brokerage firm. So let's take a look at some hypotheticals. Now, boom, 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 boom. Here, they're all on the website here. I did them automatically. I used to do them ad hoc, but I just did them now. So here's $100 a month for 30 years. And we're using this mutual fund. Not because I'm trying to get you to buy this mutual fund, because it's been around for 30, 40 years. That's one of the reasons. There are others. So you're going to get something like this prepared by, and you're going to see all these disclaimers. Investments are not FDIC insured, nor are they deposits or guaranteed by a bank or any other entity, so they may lose value. And then there's going to be a whole lot of doesn't it sound like Gregorian? When I receive it, I just want to start chanting. Figures shown are past results and not predictive of results in future periods. Because nobody reads it. It might as well be Gregorian chant. So here's the scary part. Be afraid. Be very afraid. Now, we put $100 a month for 30 years. How much is that? It turns out that's $36,000. Sounds like a lot of money, but over 30 years, that's nothing, folks, compared to how much you're spending on that car once you get that car and your smell phone, right? Over 30 years, that $36,000 became almost $200,000, which is not bad, is it? Pretty darn good. 9.74%, taking into account the fact that the 2000s were sometimes called the lost decade. And now we're going to see a graph that is not like the graph we just saw. This is not an exponential, right? This is a arithmetic. So we see the X, this is not a logarithmic scale, I'm sorry, this is not a logarithmic scale, this is an arithmetic scale, with the increments are all the same, as opposed to going up by a factor of 10. And what you start to see is that exponential growth. And then you see that it's a whole lot bumpier than it did in the logarithmic scale, isn't it? So $200,000 is pretty darn good, right? But wouldn't you like to do a whole lot better? So what we're going to do is just extend our time frame. So for you millennials, this is not hard to do. Because you start in your 20s, you're going to be working into your 70s, maybe even 80s, because lifespans are going to be a whole lot longer, providing the world doesn't change. The trend is now that people are living far longer. Supposedly the first person who's going to live to 150 has already been born. Yeah, we'll know in 100 years, but I won't. But you guys are going to live a lot longer. So here's the scary part. Here's be afraid, be very afraid. And we're going to start to put $100 a month, but we're going to do that for 40 years. And we've put in $48,000, which again sounds like a lot of money, but is not over 40 years. And it's almost $900,000, $875,000. At 11.6%. Because, you know, more years and the 2000s are smoothed out. Exciting?
Yeah.
Oh, good. That's why I love having millennials in my class, because I want you guys to get started early. Yes?
Once you start on something like that for like 30 years, it's locked in for 30 years, right?
No, oh no, you can stop at any time. You can call your broker, call the mutual fund, go online. If it's your 401k, go to your human resources and just say, I'm going to stop right now. Or you can, there's so easy. You can skip a month. You go in and click here, I want to skip this month. No problem. Or I want to put an extra $50 in, you can put an extra $50. Very, very convenient. Very easy.
And you get a fee when you skip a month?
No. Maybe some mutual funds do, but most of them I work with don't. No, they understand. They know. They've heard it all, folks. And some of them want you to do at least $50 a month. And they'll say, you know, our minimum is $50 a month. But what I've convinced them other times, but usually they don't want to listen to me. I've had clients, I said, call them up and cry. Okay? Make sure you get a guy. If you get a woman, just, you know, do a little dancing and call up and get a guy. And say, I can only afford $25. Okay, little lady. And it's always worked. They've always done it. And then let's take a look at the graph. And again, we see that exponential, but it's a mess. Now, here's another one. Can you put $100 a month in this year? And then next year, put in $110. You know, two fewer trips to $5. All right? Can you do that? Okay, because if you can do that, watch what happens. We start with $100 a month, and we then next year put in $110 a month. And the year after that, $120 a month. So hopefully our income is growing. We're paying down debt. And so over the 40 years, we will put $141,000, which sounds like a lot of money, but think about how much he's going to spend on a car cars over the next 40 years, and it's dwarfed by that. But that $141,000 is $1.5 million, not quite, 11.26%. See?
I think I could find it in my heart to live on $1 million.
I think you could too, but you got to start early, because what? How? Okay, let's see the graph. The graph is going to look basically the same, that exponential growth. Because what happens when you're a boomer or a late Gen Xer? You're going to come up and they go, why didn't you tell me this 20 years ago, 25 years ago? Because now you don't have as much time. You got to put away a lot more. And if you hit a patch like the 2000s, it's not going to be pretty. Here's somebody, say they're 485. They can afford $500 a month. So they're going to put $500 a month for 20 years. And so we go over here, and we see that they put in $120,000. And, you know, they've gotten almost 8%, which is not bad. But, you know, it's only $280,000. Plus, they had to endure 2000 to 2002, 140 down to 96. And then, no, that was 1987. I'm sorry, 1987. 2000 to 2002 doesn't even look that much. But from 1907, 140 to 96. Let's go back to that other one. Let's go back to the other one here and show you what happened in 2000. It was painful, folks. It was really painful. I like one guy called me. I lost $400. You want to know how much I lost? Where is it? Oops, wrong. I'm missing it. At the end of 2007, we had 895. And then at the end of 2008, 588. And it went down even more until March. But if you hung on, questions, thoughts, ideas, comments? Is this illuminating? Good. Okay. And as I said before, I'm not trying to get you to buy Investment Company of America. It's a very good mutual fund. Go ahead and buy it if you want. But it's not the one I normally recommend to people who are just starting out, especially younger folks, because it's mostly domestic, and I like global, but that's me. The cool thing is it's not the only one that's been around for 50, 60, 70 years. And these are all very good companies, folks. I'm not that big a fan of Dreyfus, and Fidelity pisses me off every once in a while. But look at Dodge and Cox. They have two funds from that time frame, and both of them are awesome. They now have six. They just added a sixth fund. They're strange. There's American. Vanguard's got one, but they're not that old a company, actually. But look at T. Rowe Price. Look at the small cap fund. 13%. But hell of a lot more volatile. Small companies. Franklin, very good company. Yeah. So there are, and again, the main criteria for these guys is they're all over 50 years old. I'm not saying you should buy any of these. I like Dodge and Cox. I like American. I like Oppenheimer's got some good fun. They're all on the website. But there's just, remember, there's thousands of these things, folks. Come on in. So, yes. Start your own mutual fund? Yeah, it's pretty easy to do. You'll need some serious change. You'll need some. I think you can start it with a little. Well, that's what. Ooh, wait a minute. Start again. What did you say? Rephrase your question again. You want to start an investment club? I don't know here. What's the new show called Better Call Sal or something like that? It's about the guy who's a sleazy lawyer. I'm not sure I understood your question, but if you wanted to start your own mutual fund, you could do it. In fact, it's pretty darn easy. The key is to raise the cash. You've got to have come up with serious cash. And then once you've done that, you've got to get investors to buy into it. It's not easy to do because there's thousands of the damn things, right? If you wanted to start an investment club with other folks together, that's a whole lot easier. And that's you wouldn't anywhere near the regulatory oversight. But you could start your own mutual fund simply by buying individual stocks on your own, and which is what we did. We started a mutual fund with 10 stocks, right? We don't call it a mutual fund because we're just doing it here in class, but that's the idea. You can have your own stocks and put 20 stocks or 30 stocks together, and you have your own little mutual fund. Yes? Investment clubs are very cool, but you have to be careful. You're joining a partnership. We'll discuss those more when we get to Chapter 5. But investment clubs have been around for decades, and they're great. Their key is not so much making money as it is education. But you have skin in the game. You are literally you know, putting money into the market. And some investment clubs have done very, very well. I joined one once, had a great time, but we mostly we got together for breakfast. And I remember one investment club, they got together not for solid foods. they mostly got together just to get drunk. And they actually did pretty well. Their investments did pretty well. So now, what about the investors? How do the investors do? This gets back to George's question. We tell ourselves we want to buy low and sell high, right? But is that what many mutual investors do?
No.
No, they do the exact opposite. Now, this graph's a little tricky, but the red is the performance of the market. The green is the inflows and outflows of mutual funds. So in the late 90s, the market was doing gangbusters. The inflows peaked just when the market crashed. Right? Oh, is it too late to get in? And then people started pulling out their money as the market bottomed. Right before it shot back up, they were still pulling money out of the mutual funds. It went straight up in 2003. And what happens? People put their money back in. And what happens when it drops like a stone, the market, what do? They pull it out at the exact worst time. They pull it out. And they kept pulling it out throughout the 2009, 10, 11, 12. And now I think they're starting to come back. I think the inflows are starting to come back in. Well, think about it. They would have done what we saw in the hypothetical. But if they would have pulled it out at the bottom, you see what they're doing? They're locking in that loss. Make sense? Does it make sense? What people do is they buy high, sell low. And we'll discuss this in more detail when we get to investor psychology, investor sentiment, and the like. And that's why dollar cost averaging is so cool, because you don't worry about that. You just keep putting $50, $100 a month away, more if you can afford it. If it's great, the market's really great, it's going to crash. Probably, yeah, you're probably right. I don't know when, but it's going to crash. We know it's going to. Then it crashed. Oh my God, you're taking money out? No, I'm going to put more money in. People just thought I was nuts in 2008 and 9. What are you doing? Did you put your money out? Hell no. In fact, I put some more in. They looked at me. Are you crazy? I said, yeah, probably. We'll see in 5 years. The thing about it is if the whole thing crashes and burns and there's nothing left, it doesn't matter where you have your money. Oh, I'm going to put it in gold. Great. What's it going to do for you? You can't buy anything. There's no food at the Vons. There's no gas at the Chevron station. No clothes at the Gap. Cell phones aren't working. Trash isn't being picked up. SDG&E is offline. Cell phones aren't working. I said that already. The schools, the banks, the hospitals, the fire departments are all shuttered. What are you going to do? How much ammo do you have? A lot of ammo. How much is a lot? 4,000 rounds?
Less than that.
There's 100,000 people coming your way looking for food. And another 200,000 after them. How are they going to shoot? That's what the survivalists don't think about that. I got 4,000 rounds of ammunition. Ain't enough. Plus, if you kill 4,000 people, now what do you do with the bodies? You better. Well, I guess you could. Hey, folks, come on, free me, fresh meat. Yeah. What?
So, like my aunt, right before the downturn in 2008 or whatever it was, told me that she just by chance, when she first started hearing the news, just by chance, decided to pull the money. She had a Fidelity, and she decided to move it over.
Yeah, move it over into what? Into cash? Money market?
She put it into some
CD or something like that?
Yeah.
Called market timing. It's very, if she's
she
good.
The next day,
it went down. Okay, well then when do you get back in? It's not easy. So the bottom line on mutual funds, dear students, okay, you're going to need your handout from mutual fund chapter 4. I have some extras. Is choose a fund family, stick with them. You know, the biggest, most important decision is the first decision, and reevaluate your. It's the front page has mutual funds on it, and the back page has the case studies. We're going to take a look at some case studies right now. Hang on to them. Pass these around. Because don't be one of the mutual fund investors that does worse than your mutual fund. All right. So it's in the back of chapter 4 handout. So we're going to take a look at some case studies. Make changes judiciously. You like that word, judiciously? Sounds like delicious. I like it. As you approach retirement, migrate from stocks funds to bond funds. But don't give up on stocks entirely, folks. We're going to discuss that later on. People are living far longer. You still need the stocks. And then dollar cost average. $50, $100 a month. But for whatever you can afford, for the most part, forget about them. And they should serve you well. And we are done with mutual funds. Cool? Questions, thoughts, ideas? Yes. Well, it depends. The question was, how much did you put into a mutual fund? How much did you put into individual stocks? Some of you, and some of them are already gone, realize that investing ain't for you. you're just going to realize this ain't for me. This is boring. This is ridiculous. I'm not even going to try. In which case, stick with the mutual funds. But it depends on the individual. Some people don't like mutual funds. They don't want to bother with them. They want to buy individual stocks. Great. We're going to show you what should be the vast majority, what types of stocks should be the vast majority of your portfolio. Sure, go ahead, buy a GoPro or a Skitter or whatever. You know, you'll be exciting. But what are the companies that you want to be the vast majority? Turn to page 6. Turn to page 6 of the handout I gave you, and you'll see, I think it's page 6, you'll see the top 75 companies in this mutual fund. Is it page 6? Okay. These are what we call large cap companies, meaning big companies that have their roots deep in the economy. Now, some of them are growthy. Which page are you on? Page 6. No, not page 6. I'm page 4. I don't know. Page 4. Turn to page 4. Page 4. But many of these companies you know, some of them you don't know, and they have their roots deep in the economy. So yes, they're going to bounce up and down, but most of them are going to be around in 20, 30 years, 50 years. What's the first one? Well, that's a growthier one. Gilead Sciences, that's one of their growth. This is a growth and income fund. Gilead Sciences was the first company, another one's coming out with it, to cure hepatitis C. And the drug came out a year ago. You had to take 90 pills, 87 to 90 pills, one a day. Each pill costs $1,000. Hepatitis C is a very dangerous disease. Many people have it. They don't even know it. It's asymptomatic. It won't kill them. They'll have it for the rest of their life. They'll die of something else. They'll never even know they have hepatitis C. Other people, they will get liver cancer and die a very horrible death. The only other way to cure hepatitis C, which wasn't the best cure, was interferon. It was only 40% effective, and it meant you had to live a year of the worst cold you can imagine. They would induce interferon in your system, which is the drug or the chemical that makes you feel really horrible during a flu. And you felt, and most people just couldn't hack it. They just said after a couple of months, this is it, I can't live this way, I'd rather die. And so, and then even if you did survive the whole year, it was only 40% effective. So Gilead Sciences said, we've cured it! $1,000 a pill, please. But most of the other companies are not like Gilead. Who is it? Who's out there? AT&T, Comcast. Who is the Comcast? They're big, Coca-Cola, Nike, UPS, Texas Instruments, BP. That's the kind of companies, if you buy individual stocks, those are the kind of companies that you want to have the bulk of your investments in. Go ahead, buy a Gilead Sciences, buy a Titter, buy a Farcebook. Who else is hot these days? But for the most part, I'm not telling you should buy this company. One of the best examples of the company that should be one of your, you know, ideas of what a good company is Waste Management Incorporated. Are people going to be playing with Farcebook in 30 years? Or Titter in 30 years? I don't know. Maybe.
But are they going to be picking up the trash in 30 years? Yeah. That's not going away. So that's the kind of company. I'm not saying you should go buy waste management. But that's the kind of company. Did I answer your question? So it's up to you. You could put 50% in mutual funds, 50% in your own individual stocks, 75% in mutual funds. What I did is I kept over 90% in mutual funds. And then with the, it was actually less than, it was a few percent of my individual, my wife and mine. And I bought individual stocks. And the ones that I followed Benjamin Graham's rules that we're going to discuss later on, I did okay. And the ones where I rolled the dice and said, this company might be the kind of company that goes from $1,000 to $550,000, the Gilead Sciences of the world, everyone I lost. But everyone went up first. They all went up first. So I was excited. And then they... So, you know, it's up to you. That's why there are markets. That's where there are markets. Did I answer your question? Okay, now let's take a look at the. I don't even remember. Was it you, right? Was you? Or,
yeah.
You asked it. Okay, did I answer it?
Oh, no.
Oh, no. Okay, tell me. So I ask you. Please ask you. Okay, be careful. You got to be careful when you ask a professor a question. We can talk a whole lot longer. Most people want to listen.
Say, for example, like you. $90%
If you had, let's say you had $10,000. Let's make it easy. I would put $9,000 into high quality mutual funds, and for you, stock mutual funds, and then go ahead and play the market with the other 10%. Go ahead, buy individual stocks. The problem is, you need about $500, $600, or $800 to buy one stock. And we'll discuss this as we go along. That's what I would do. That's what I would suggest. With 90% of your money, put it into well-managed, high-quality mutual funds that have a long-term perspective and have done well in good times and bad. But everyone's different. It's your money. I can't tell you what to do. You could come say, Frank, and this is what... What do you recommend? I'll tell you, this is what I recommend. You do it. It's up to you whether you do it or not. Am I answering your question?
Yeah.
Okay, good. All right. So, yes.
How long should your stock be doing bad before you decide to cut ties
with? Oh, that's such a hard question. When we get through Chapter 5, we're going to get to Chapter 6. And Chapter 6 is common stock valuation. And there are many different investment theories, investment strategies. But I'm going to show you a strategy that allows you to look ahead four years. And so if the company is doing poorly, the stock is doing poorly, but the company is still doing well, and you look at the four-year time horizon, you say, no, this is a good time to buy more shares. It doesn't mean you're right. But we're going to learn techniques that allow us to look ahead 2 or 3 or 4 years. You just redo the technique. And then after you've done it, you throw it all away. And you say, do I really want to own this company? Do I really want to own FedEx? Do I really want to own Nike? Do I really want to own Gilead Sciences? Because all the techniques that are out there, and there are dozens and dozens, we're going to learn a few, are imperfect. They're all just, you know, smoke and mirrors, blowing wind around. And all you're doing, I hope what I'm going to show you is you're going to tilt the odds in your favor. And that's all you have to do. You don't have to win big. You just have to win. Some people think you have to win big. Good luck. All I can say is good luck. I want to win. I don't care if I win big. I got one guy here who keeps trying to get me buy Alibaba. And he's sharp. He's sharp. But he keeps thinking, go buy Alibaba. I say, no, I don't want Alibaba. Don't want Alibaba. I know I'm not interested. We'll discuss that later. Okay, now let's take a look at the handout I gave you. Some of you already have it. We don't have too much time here. What I'd like to do is get into groups, but we don't have time for that. Because I'm going to ask you on the exam, what would you do? Here's a list of mutual funds. What would you do? And so let's take a look at the case studies. I'm going to read it. Anybody have an extra? Because I've ran out.
Okay. A childless couple in their mid-40s wants you to help them start an investment program. They have just received a $50,000 inheritance from their wife's parents. They say that they will not need the money until retirement. They each make a respectable salary and already own their own home. They currently have no savings, and although each has a 401k program at work, neither has taken advantage of it. The husband once lost all $15,000 of an inheritance playing the commodities futures market. The idea of investing makes them very, very nervous. So what do you do with somebody in their 40s? How long do they have until retirement? 20, 30 years, maybe longer, you know, 20, let's say 20 years, mid-40s, 60, mid-60s. And they don't have anything saved up. Is this typical? Yeah, because people in their 20s and 30s, they go, I got plenty of time. And then in their 40s, they go, you know, I got better start thinking about this. I'm in trouble. And they don't have the 20, 30, they don't have the 40 years, the 30 years I showed you. They have the 20 years. So what would you put them? Now, what you could do is also have that scramble sheet in front of you and remember the continuum from, you know, aggressive stocks to boring bonds to money markets. What would you do? And when I ask people that, they go, you know, they just get that deer in the headlights there. I don't know. Municipal bonds? Do they need a whole lot of bonds? They could, if they're really, really worried. Yeah, I guess you're right. That's a good choice. But, see, I'll tell you, I think they need balance. I think they need stocks and, as David's right, they need some bonds. Muni bonds, what we're going to find out, muni bonds are for people who have a lot of money. When you have a lot of money, you have a lot of taxes, muni bonds become very, very desirable, very, very attractive. But for most of us working grunts, eh. But they do need some bonds, right? Because they're terrified. So what a good I'm giving you the answer. I would give them a balance fund. And maybe put some growth in income. I'm a big fan of growth in income. But you got to warn them it's going to be bumpy. Show them the up and down. Show them the chart. Questions, thoughts? Now, what I notice when I ask you this, what some people say is they put half of it in the money market and half of it in the aggressive growth. That's what some people will do when you ask them. Give them their own druthers. Now, what do you think of that? That's called, there's a name for that. It's called a barbell approach. And I can't draw, but it's supposed to be a barbell. Does it look like a barbell? No. Does that look like a barbell? Yeah, okay. Is that better? So you have really, you know, risky investments, and then you have investments that aren't going to lose a dime. Do you like that idea? It's up to you. I don't think it's that great. I want them to get in the middle. Yeah. I want to get them in the middle. You know, some stocks, some bonds, and put them in the middle somewhere. But everyone's different. That's the key. Everyone's different. I'm not sure if I'm getting through to you guys. You're kind of looking at me. All right, how about the next one? A young woman in her early 20s has just graduated from college and landed a job as an elementary school teacher. She has $18,000 in student loans. Can you guys relate? Yes. Well, that's why I want you to answer that, damn it. I would take the whole thing and allocate it across the spectrum. But I would not go to money market. They don't need, unless they tell you, oh, you know what, we're going to need $5,000 for the kids' schooling in 6 months. Okay, put $5,000 in money market. But I would either divvy it up, $5,000 here, $5,000 there, $5,000 there. You could put the whole damn thing into a balance fund, a global balance fund or a domestic balance fund. But if you picked growth and income, you'd make the professor really happy. Because what's growth? You remember our? I was debating whether I should put it up or not. I think, you remember our spectrum here? The spice,
and then the pasta, the meat and potatoes, and then the oatmeal. These were the growth funds, the aggressive growth, the capital appreciation, growth and income. This is where I normally start people, especially younger folks. I start them here. I recommend a growth and income fund. And then the equity income fund. Make sure you know these mutual fund designations on the spread, on the scramble sheet and the fee classes. I try to get people to start right here, especially if they're younger. Because it's stocks. It's going to be volatile, but nowhere near as volatile as the growth, the aggressive growth, the capital appreciation funds. And then, after the market dumps, I'll call them up and say, now, how did you do? Were you worried? And if they say, I didn't even look at it, bingo, then you give them a growth fund. I don't like aggressive growth, but you give them a growth. You understand? Because it's how they react emotionally when the market dumps. If they said, oh, I lost $50, you go, okay, put you in an equity income or a balance fund, more like putting you in a balance fund, because that's even going to be less volatile. Because there's an intellectual part and there's an emotional part. So did I answer your question? I don't know. I'm not trying to give you a specific answer, because that's wrong. That's my answer. You want your answer.
Why don't you like aggressive growth?
Because people are people. And they get terrified.
But I have a couple of fairly aggressive funds.
But I don't tell people that. I certainly didn't tell my wife, because in 2000 to 2002, one lost almost 60%. The same one lost 60%. I kept putting money in. And then in 2008, it lost over 50%. But it's been my best performing investment. But see, I don't recommend it. And I don't tell people I don't usually tell people I have it. And people are people. I got to tell you, folks, it was not fun. 2008 was like getting kicked in the teeth. I told you. I remember one guy called me up. I lost $400. You want to know how much I lost? You really want to know? Like, put add a couple of zeros, right? It's tough. It's not easy.
So at the end of the day, you made more money than you lost.
Oh yeah, okay. Yeah. Because I didn't pull it out when it fell. I did not pull it out when it fell. I just kept saying, okay, you know, if the world ends, it doesn't matter where the money is. That's what it's like. You're going to experience those 50% downturns. They're going to happen. And like Warren Buffett says, you hope you live long enough for it to happen again. All right, next one. Let's read the next one. Are these good? Are these going to help? Because okay, I'll tell you what I'm going to ask. I'm going to give you $20,000. How would you invest it? That's what I'm going to ask you. All right? And so I'm going to give you a list of mutual funds, and you decide what you want. Let's read the second one, because a lot of these are in you're in this situation. This is a woman who just graduated. She's got a job as a teacher. She has a 403B available at work. Her father's on her to start investing. She has $18,000 worth of student debt. Okay, some of you, or maybe friends, yeah? What do you tell her? Deafening silence. What do you think? Anybody want to try? You don't have to be right. Remember, would you get her started with a growth and income?
I would start off with a balance.
You start with the balance. Both are good choices. The balance. She's really worried, right? She's really worried. But she said, "But what about all the debt?" What do you tell her then? Yeah, you're going to pay it off. But that doesn't mean you shouldn't put $50 a month or $100 a month into your 403B or Roth IRA. You deal with it. And student debt is, you know, sometimes one of the best debt you can have, because the interest rates can be low. Sometimes they're a little high. So you try to get her to the point where she feels comfortable putting $50 on. And this is my humble opinion. Just get her started. She's young, right? She gets into the habit of putting money away. And then next year, can she put in 55? Can you put in 60? Make sense? Now, last couple, that's a little tough. And you're going to run into situations where people are basically strapped for cash. The last one is that This is the divorced couple, mid-30s. They want to start something for their kids. They have two children. Neither is remarried. They have joint custody, and so far the divorce has been amicable. Although both are working, neither has a 401k plan at work, and the father just received $10,000 from an accident. They say that money are tight. What do you do for them? What do you tell them to do? Yeah, they're in their 30s. But where do they put it? Should they put it in their 401k? In a Roth IRA? It's up to you. When you put it in a retirement account, you can get it out for education, qualified higher education, whether it's a Roth or a 401k or a regular account or one of these educational savings accounts. I'm not a big fan of educational savings accounts. Why? Because if you use them, then you lose the ability to take advantage of the tax credits that you're given when you send somebody to college or when you go to college. What a kick in the teeth that is. I tell them, put it in a Roth, put it in a 401k, or put it in a regular account. Don't put it in the education savings plan. Plus, what? Well, it depends. If you take it out for qualified higher education, you don't get charged a penalty, but you still have to pay the taxes. You still have to pay the taxes, but you didn't pay the taxes on the way in. And if you use it one of these 529 plans, they look at the 529 plan when you fill out the FAFSA form. Have you noticed it's called FAFSA? Not FAFSA. Everyone calls it FAFSA. No, it's the FAFSA form. When you filled out the FAFSA form, did they ask you how much was in your Roth IRA or your parents' Roth IRA or their 401ks? No. No. See, retirement accounts don't apply on a FAFSA form. But educational savings accounts? Yes. Yeah. So what I tell people, if they have plenty of money in their 401k, they filled up their Roth IRA, they have extra cash, go ahead, put it in a 529 plan. And it turns out, folks, 529 plans are very popular with the very wealthy. But for most of us working grunts, I don't think they're a good deal. Because the very wealthy don't get to take advantage of those tax credits. They don't get to take advantage of financial aid because they have too much money. So they don't care about that. But the working grunts, we do get to take advantage of the educational tax credits, and we do get to normally take advantage of financial aid. Make sense? So I tell them, start your Roth IRA. They don't have 401ks. And with that $10,000, maybe a growth in income, equity income, or balance. So I hope I answered your question. Yes? These you can hang on to. I do. After you're done with it, please give it back. I can use it again. But they're at their end of their lifespan. Within a few months, they're going to come out with a new one, and then those will all have to be thrown away. So hang on to it, but bring it back if you're done with it. Do awesome on Thursday, folks. I'm rooting for you guys. David Randell here? No. All right, who snuck in late? Get lots of sleep. Yes.